Google did a study back in 2017 called Project Aristotle. And, they chose the name Aristotle for his famous quote of the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So when we think about consciousness and we think about teams and why, operationalizing it and integrating it is so critical, it is because people come to work to bring to life their life's purpose, right? Their dharma on the planet.
Welcome to Mindful Warrior Radio. Mindful Warrior Radio holds a space for stories of leadership, culture, performance, and flow, tapping into the wisdom and mastery of innovative change makers and leaders from a wide range of diverse fields. My name is Cami Craig. I'm a former elite athlete, Olympic champion, turned performance and culture design coach at Mindful Warrior, and I'm your host of Mindful Warrior Radio. Thanks for joining us. Today on Mindful Warrior Radio, we are thrilled to welcome Susan Ferrero, a social entrepreneur who has founded five multi-million dollar organizations focused on transforming workforce education and advancing social impact. With 45 years of experience and a commitment to youth activism as a valuable insight for today's global market, Susan's pioneering ideas continue to inspire change. Her latest book, Superloop, offers a roadmap for revolutionizing work, leadership, and personal growth by bridging self-awareness and organizational success. We are thrilled to welcome on Susan today's episode of Mindful Warrior Radio. Pleasure to have you on Mindful Warrior Radio. I'm so excited to have you here as a guest and just receive all of your knowledge, wisdom, and insight from the world and the life that you've been living the last few years.
Thanks, Cami. I really appreciate being here. I'm thrilled. Listen to your work. I'm a fan and a follower, and you attract some really unique and interesting people. So I am humbled to be among one of those. So thank you for that.
Oh,
Amongst one of those.
awesome.
Yeah, great.
Thank you so much. So let's jump straight in. I wanted to start by asking, you started a chain of early childhood schools called Little Sprouts because you wanted to see and create a different kind of school. And I'm curious of what did you do differently? What did you find and what did you do differently starting there?
So, my first Little Sprouts Child Enrichment Center school was I launched when I was 17 years old. And it was a direct correlation of the education system that I came from and the observations I had regarding equity, even at a young age in the classrooms. And what I realized was I came from a family of five girls. I had no brothers. My mom had no brothers, my dad had no brothers. And when I watched, and this started in kindergarten, the energy of boys that was really intense, but how it was suppressed and they got in trouble all the time. And there was this dynamic around that education system that I just knew that there something better could be done and that equity could be available at multiple levels. And then as I grew in the education system, it started, there was a classism around what students were performing at A plus and what students were not. So then that showed up, and so as young as second grade, I would stay in on my recesses and help tutor these three young men that were in my school. For years, I tutored them, and it's funny in hindsight, right? It's like, well, of course, that's what I did, right? And so being in the education world, and especially with young children, was something critically important to me because I really believe that the five and under crowd, right? Those humans that are, birth to 5 years, their innocence and their connection to their authentic self, to the divine, is so pure and so real that it connects us back to you know, who we're supposed to be in the world, the innocence, the curiosity, the immediate emotion, you know, the temper tantrum happens, then it's over, and that's the end of it. And so it was not even a question for me as regarding if I was going to be working with children or not working with children. And I worked in early childhood. So I did internships in high school, and I worked in, at the time it was called KinderCare. They're still around, one of the biggest, you know, providers of early childhood in the world. And then I also worked in a public school. Both of those systems had, for me, you know, I was 16, 17 years old working there, just incredible dysfunction of the adults. So when I created Little Sprouts, I knew that this was going to be something that was about engagement, about drawing out from the child their curiosity, rather than me, you know, kind of shoving information into them. Yes, we're going to learn new things, and yes, I'm going to be the teacher, but it is this dynamic flow between those two things. And so with Little Sprouts, you know, as we grew, I knew very early on that the children were going to be the gift, and it was the grownups that were really struggling with how to be present for the children, right? The you know, the people that they served, it was really challenging on some days, moments, times for them as grownups because of all the other things they were dealing with in life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I realized that very early on, I started focusing on the work environment in a physical sense. And so we added things into Little Sprouts, such as aromatherapy in all of the classrooms and hallways. We added, you know, cultural reflective music in the hallways. So at pick up and drop off times, parents, you know, could experience that. We changed the light bulbs in our classrooms so that they were not, you know, lights that had so much vibration that it was impacting the students. We created policies where we only put 30% of our walls were covered. The rest of them were open so that it wasn't overstimulating. And so those types of environments, you know, were really important. That impacted the adult learning as well as the child learning. So, and then for the adults, we did things like, you know, we had someone, a good friend of mine, that made meals for the adults, and they could buy meals at a really affordable price, and she would pre-make them. We brought massage therapy into the environment so that the teachers would get massage chair massage once a month. So all of those, you know, deeper needs of the human being came into play, and we addressed them in a very real, concrete way, environmentally and then operationally as well.
Wonderful. What from the school environment did you start learning? Because I'm hearing you say, you know, it wasn't just about completely focusing on the children. It was actually focusing on the adults in the room as well, who were facilitating the learning for the children. Yeah. And giving them the capacity and threshold and regulation within their nervous system to be fully present and accessible to the children in the room. And so this idea of focusing on the adult and focusing on the environment, at some point you have either done the jump or you created more space to not only work in the school environment, but in corporate as well. Can you tell me a little bit about what you took from the school environment that you saw applied to the corporate environment and that jump of starting to integrate your practice and your work into the corporate environment?
Absolutely. Because I had worked in early childhood predominantly for the first 20 years of my career, it was, which we started in 1982. So towards the late 90s, early 2000s, I started taking the model that I was using inside of my system at Little Sprouts. We had 5 locations at that point. And I started offering friends and family, you know, really good partners that I had developed strategic partnerships with. If I could go into their places of work, and I volunteered to sit on teams so that I could see if what I was doing would translate over into another industry. And I worked with, you know, entry-level populations in the hospitality industry and the healthcare industry. I started writing funding applications and getting grants for those populations. And then I went in and delivered the services and then measured it to see if we were getting the same kind of outcomes with the humans in different environments. And it was a great learning experience because I had to be translating all the time. Because if they're talking about manufacturing or the food industry or, you know, you know, kind of enrollment processes inside of systems. You know, we didn't do any of that inside of my industry. And yet I learned so much by being the outlier to the entire system.
And I'm kind of hearing it didn't even matter what the focus or the industry of whatever organization that you were within. What you knew is your practice and how you showed up was going to apply to all these differences, because at a basic level, we're all human with human needs that are right. working to regulate their nervous system or our nervous system to right. be able to show up wholly and fully to the work that we're doing.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a great way to think about it, really, in this way, Cammie, which is, you know, our experiences and thinking create the biology of today from the past. And that is a generalistic human principle. And so, to your point, that's exactly what it was. When I realized, and I just started getting into cognitive neuroscience at that time. And when I realized that, it didn't matter if they were the CEO or the first day entry level person, they were still challenged with their own self-awareness, their own self-accountability, their ability to regulate themselves in a way that met their needs as well as met the needs of other people on the team. And that, you know, kind of general foundation and grounding of that reality was somewhat funny to some extent, because, you know, we have all of these, you know, classes and caste systems in our brain when we're growing up, and we think that, oh, well, they're better because it's not. A human is a human is a human is a human. And it doesn't matter what credentials, what you've had, you may speak different words, but your neurology is your neurology. Our, you know, beliefs inform our brain matter. It's the architect of our brain, really, our thoughts and our beliefs. Our brain involves the health of our own system. We're priming it, whether we know we are or not, to do the same thing again and again. And so that balance shows up in behavior. And so, you know, what we say at G3 is we judge ourselves off of our intention. We judge others off of behavior. And behavior is the external part of what we're looking at. It is the front facing, the you know, 3D world that we live in. All the other wiring, the thoughts, we can't see any of that. We know they're real because we think and, you know, we do those things, but we don't engage with them like they really matter. And they are part of the architecture of our health, of our relational health, our self-health, our physical health, our spiritual health, and our emotional health.
Yeah, absolutely. How would you define consciousness? I mean, I think we're kind of in that realm right now of what you're talking about, but how would you define, from your experience and your perspective, how would you define consciousness?
Consciousness is awareness. Simply put, we complicate it and it sounds so esoteric, like, oh, it's out there. It's not. It is an awareness of ourself. It is being the witness of ourself. It is metacognition. It is self-reflection. It is making sure that you are observing yourself in as close to real time as you can. And it is being aware. And it takes practice. Because what's happening is we have 70 to 80,000 thoughts, you know, now they call them thought worms, okay? And they've now defined it, the neuroscientists, as 6 to 7,000 thought worms a day that just are on autoplay. They just go through our mind, they're the same information that is creating our biology, and we think it's consciousness. We think what we're thinking is consciousness, and it's not. It's our mind thinking thoughts. That is not consciousness. Thinking is the opposite. It's the antithesis part of consciousness. Consciousness is the ground of being. It is really just this openness that we have. It is a beginner's mind without any thought at all.
Organizationalizing consciousness. What does that mean?
I'm going to ask you first, what did it mean to you the first time that you saw that word, Cammie?
When I look at this, to me, it feels like the whole consciousness, the collective consciousness of a group. And that group could be, in this particular phrase that I'm bringing from your book, it sounds like it's the organization's shared consciousness. So that's what I'm getting from it. And I'd love for you to expand on that.
Sure. I appreciate you weighing in on that. And yes, that is absolutely a piece of it. So in the book, I use a framework that was developed based on the frameworks of Carl Jung and Ken Wilber in his integral theory. It is about looking through the lens of life in the I, the we, and the all. It is in those three categories. Mm-hmm. Consciousness shows up in that same way. And it shows up in the individual. It shows up between you and I right now, right? I'm either thinking about what I'm going to say to you, or I am in the space with you, actually being with you. Totally different. And as well as in an organization, in a team, in a group, in the all, there is a way to be present, right? Which is another somewhat term for that, about what's going on here now and not listening to those 70 to 80,000 thoughts in your head. And so the term operationalized in consciousness, and it is a bit of a tongue twister, which is why we didn't use that as the name, but I've been using that term for almost 20 years. And it started with, you know, really a combination of my work when I was working and studying with Dr. Stephen Covey, and then in collaboration and tandem with Dr. Deepak Chopra. And, you know, Stephen Covey was really the business guru. And yet, as you worked with him, he was very careful about bringing spirituality into the space at the time because of his Mormon background, and he didn't want to collapse those two. And Deepak was more about spirituality and less about business structure. So I had the great, unbelievable miracle of working with both of these humans when they were developing their initial genesis of their models. And, you know, got to contribute in multiple ways to both of them. But what I realized was there was a huge opportunity for the humans to take both of those things. How do I create this awareness and then create the practices that are going to most evoke that awareness inside of the system on a consistent basis? And then, you know, as I continued growing, another term came up, which was a deliberately developmental organizations. And that phrase was created by Bob Keegan and Lisa Leahy. And why that is important is that in the early 2000s, the whole model of developmental psychology moved into, based on Bob Keegan's work, understanding that developmental psychology wasn't just for children and adolescents. It was for adults forever and ever and ever, that were constantly growing and changing. And so that kind of concept of designing in your space places where you are going to be evoking consciousness and actually calling forward the ability for people to be present, to be communicating in a way that was authentic, that they were not having to repress information. They were not having to put on this mask and be someone else. It was like, we're going to talk about this really tough topic, and we're going to give each other space to make mistakes, right? To really create functional failure is what we call it, right? That has to be part of the process, or no one's going to show up. So the operationalizing consciousness was about making sure that we were creating deliberately developmental organizations. We were designing the daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, annually behaviors that were aligned so that we were creating environments where people could show up, be themselves, self-regulate by what we call it G3, saying the unsaid. What are you really wondering? What are you curious about that you want to bring into this space? And there is over 100 ways to be able to do that. And I name probably 30 or 40 of them in Superloop. And the next book is going to be a field guide to get even deeper. But the opportunity to operationalize the ability for humans to be in awareness, you know, is the next level of organizational development. It's what the market is looking for. It's what the humans are looking for. You know, I work with thousands of CEOs and leaders. And what is astounding is we do this process called equity audit. And no matter what comes up, okay, that, you know, there's very industry specific challenges they're having potentially, it is always ends up being about accountability, right? Both self-accountability and team accountability, and communication or the lack thereof. Those two things, right, which are executive function skills, they're not, hey, you know, we need to use HubSpot better, we need to use Salesforce better, we need to use, you know, our accounting. It's not the tools they're using, It's the human design that is challenged inside of the systems. And it's because we have now worked in corporate environments that have been so overregulated and repressed that for most of our, definitely, you know, I'm going to be 60 in a couple of weeks, most of my life. And I didn't even work in corporate America. I was on the outskirts and I would leave sometimes thinking, you know, bless their hearts, because I would not do that. So there is an opportunity to operationalize consciousness in a very deliberate way.
And really what I'm hearing is operationalized consciousness is really the awareness of self, other, and the whole. And exactly. What I'm also hearing you say is that there's got to be, and maybe I didn't hear you quite say there's got to be a level of safety, but there's a call forward of authenticity and the whole self and being able to speak, have the courage and enough safety in the room to be able to speak the third thing that's on your mind, or the thing that is unspoken that is sitting there, so that you can come fully and wholly into yourself and be authentic and be able to, again, what I'm hearing is speak what is on your mind that perhaps may remain unsaid. And what happens when you give the space and the breathing room to allow those thoughts and feelings and sensations to come forward into the room?
Yeah, that's it, Cammie. And I would add that I think there is a yearning inside of humanity to be fully self-expressed. Each one of us. And I think that that is what the world is being called on right now. It is a practice to do that. And what I also know, and if I drop into compassion, is most people that I work with from multiple levels, it's not necessarily that they don't want to contribute and say something. Yes, there is some reflection on, I don't feel safe enough to do it. My job may be at risk, okay? Which is real for people. That's real for people. However, what I will tell you is the root cause of even feeling like you may lose your job or I don't feel safe enough in this space is the lack of competency and being able to express yourself in a nonviolent way. And so the challenge comes is that if you are going to say the unsaid in a room, but you attack someone with it, which is really what ends up happening because we have stuffed this stuff down so long that we explode and we get reactive. That's where the breakdown is. And that breakdown creates the opportunity for all of us, which is we all get to learn new ways of expressing ourselves that in the very words we use takes ownership. And the example I'll give you is we have a process called justified versus empowered language. And justified language sounds like, I have to, they're making me go to this meeting. I have to get up and go to work. I have to go home and cook supper for my family and kids. They're, you know, I've asked and there's no way out of, I've got to do this. Versus I am choosing to go home and cook supper for my family. I am delighted to go home and do my laundry. I am excited that I get to be included in this meeting. I'm going to choose to do this. We are always at choice. And so the gap to actually being effective communicators is because of the fact that we don't have a lot of good models out there that do this kind of work, that talk about situations and issues from a place of respondability, the ability to respond rather than attacking and, you know, I have something to say, you know, you people shouldn't be, and that's what happens. And then it blows up and everybody's like, we ain't doing that again. And that's the end of it, right? That's how it goes.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, the next question I wanted to ask you is how do you create a safe place for this to take place? And what I'm hearing, and I'd love for you to build upon it, is perhaps maybe there are some ways that you create a safe container for this to happen for your clients or an organization or a, you know, senior leadership team, but the safety comes in actually the delivery. So it sounds like you're coaching people how to communicate, how to deliver feedback, how to deliver thoughts and feelings versus, okay, how do we safely make an environment? The safety is actually through the communication is what I'm hearing.
Beliefs, biology, and behavior. We get to check our beliefs. And so part of the process that we do with our clients is, what is your purpose for giving that information? What's your purpose? Is it to share love? Is it to create boundaries? Is it to create clarity and to ground in your intention before you even start thinking about what you're going to say? Is what is your perceived belief about why you're doing this? Is it because I'm so sick of hearing, you know, Joe talk about this, that if I don't say anything, I'm going to lose my mind, right? Or is it, I love Joe and I know that he wants to communicate this better so that my team can understand it. And so I am going to call him forward by holding him accountable to the commitments he made, by the fact that I love Joe and I want him to be successful. And that's the energy that you start speaking in. So you first connect to your intention and then you ground in that and then you engage from that space. And so we build micro practices into our system of Superloop proxies. And one of them that's really profound is a process called feed forward. And what feed forward does, as you can see, it is a play on the word feedback. And the reason we change it is because there has been multiple research projects that when humans, especially that work in organizations, hear the term feedback, they immediately have a cortisol rush. Exactly. They panic because we have been conditioned that that is a negative thing. And although, you know, we've all probably experienced good feedback that has really brought us to a new level, most of the way that our relationship with feedback is a negative experience. And so we coined a new phrase called feed forward. And the design is on a weekly basis that teams check in with each other. And the three prompts are, what I love about working with you is, what I think you can do to improve your impact, and a pattern you may or may not be aware of. And those three prompts happen inside of the space. And so what that does, Cammy, is it starts building capacity to, one, love each other more profoundly out loud, right? Because the reason why sometimes when we're giving other people critical feedback that it may sting is because we don't spend enough time acknowledging the value and the miracle of who they are and what they do for the team. And so we get into the practice of doing that so that it doesn't feel uncomfortable. It's not goofy, you know, that celebrating and receiving who you are in this world is normalized. And then the second one, which is changing authoritative leadership to peer-to-peer leadership and to an accessible egalitarian leadership, which is the boss is not in charge of telling everybody what they do right and do wrong, but we have allowed it because it's easier, because no one really likes, you know, healthy conflict. They have a real big fear of conflict. And so the ability for me to call you forward and say, hey, Cammy, you know, you come late to the meetings all the time. And my request to you is that either help us decide if we need to change the meetings, or do you think that you can show up on time, right? So, you know, what I think you could do to improve your impact is be consistently on time. That's how we would use that. And so we build those types of tools into our system so that people are practiced in doing it. They're supported in doing it. It creates psychological safety.
It's really, I'm hearing this, the accountability to peer-to-peer communication and the power of that. And the ownership of that and the positive impact that it can have. And very clearly through this, one of the practices through this, the super loop is acknowledging the person and then providing the feedback on the behavior. So you're not giving the feedback to the actual human that's in front of you, but you're actually giving the feedback to the behavior that is not the person, right? So acknowledging personhood, and then, you know, providing feedback to the behavior. And there's this, I'm hearing that you have worked to find a way to incorporate love into the corporate space in a way that feels authentic and it feels strong and it feels grounding. And I can come alongside of you as love is one of the strongest things out there. It's potent, yeah. It's powerful, and it can make incredible change. Tell me a little bit about how love is folded in or incorporated or perhaps a main pillar into the super loop practice.
Yeah. So great question and great distillation, Cammy. Love is, we have romanticized love in the world. Love is our purpose for being here as humans. It is for connection. It is about celebration. It is one of the most potent things, biologically, spiritually, energetically, that we can offer to each other. Yet we let other things kind of snuff that out because we've been taught that that kind of language doesn't belong in the workplace. That's unprofessional. And so we are in the state that we are in with 70% of people not wanting to be in their jobs for that reason, because we have taken love out of the workplace. You know, Khalil Gibran, work is love made manifest. End scene. And I believe that, right? Martin Luther King died standing up for the sanitation workers, right? In Tennessee, that's what he was doing there. His, you know, the great march that we all celebrate every year, you know, was the march for jobs and freedom, right? Jobs and freedom have been connected in this great United States of America, but also globally to create equity for eons. And yet we still are kind of pushing back like, yeah, I should be kind and loving here. I should be able to show up in a way that I can acknowledge that. You know, you will hear teams that I work on, they will tell each other, I love you. Thank you for doing that. You know, and people feel like it is unusual. And yet I would tell you it is an idea whose time has come for us to value. We spend so much time at work with each other, and to value the contributions by acknowledging, you know, sometimes this is really hard and I love you anyway.
The power of love, the potency.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you this. How does centering consciousness and humanity? So we've talked a bit about consciousness. We've talked now about the human in front of us and the power of love. How does centering consciousness and humanity maximize performance outcomes for teams?
That's a great one. Well, I am in the middle of the science project because we've been measuring these outcomes for over 20 years now. And there's enough out there on, you know, the connection of work, family, and life. You know, Google did a study back in 2017 called Project Aristotle. And, you know, they chose the name Aristotle for his famous quote of the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And so when we think about consciousness and we think about teams and why, you know, operationalizing it and integrating it is so critical, it is because people come to work to bring to life their life's purpose, right? Their Dharma on the planet. That's why they go. That's ultimately the best connection between your human beingness and the organization and or the work that you do, is that it lights you up and turns you on so consistently that you just want to be part of that. That's what keeps people. Everybody's, you know, trying to measure, you know, loyalty and all of these terms that really are talking about creating places of belonging that people want to be there. They're loyal and they are willing to do whatever it takes to get the job done, because they are committed to your mission and the team that create that mission so potently that they've got that put me in, coach, whatever it takes kind of mentality. And when that goes away, you minimize the results. You are trying to pull people over the finish line. They've lost their soul connection to why they're there, and they just stop performing. And it happens all the time by default. Leaders would not design that. But it happens by default because we're not doing both, which is honoring the human and honoring the system at the same time.
And so the combination of the two really creates this powerful forward movement and this this internal motivation. It's an alignment of the vision of the company and the purpose of the individual that's working within the company. And I like this idea. I love this idea of, you know, when we are probably in a space of awareness where you can be lit up by the work that we're doing, because it's in alignment with our morals, our values, who we are and what our gifts are in the world. So we have started to, I'm sure, pull from the Super Loop system or process. I mean, you can help me with the language of how you speak about the super loop and how you're bringing it into this world. Could you give for our listeners, you just came out with your book, The Super Loop, and you're sharing all kinds of rich information in it. And there is a guidebook or a workbook to come, which is exciting. Can you share a little bit of the framework of what is a super loop? How does it work? And I know that we're probably talking about elements of it and maybe core elements of it, but invite us into that. Share a little bit about what that's all about.
Yeah, sure. So we have, you know, what science calls positive feedback cycles inside of our own system. We look at the super loop of beliefs, biology and behavior as a self-reinforcing system. And in fact, that is a biological fact. What you continue to do again and again primes the system to continue to get those results. And when we landed on super loop and decided that that was going to be the core piece of the work and how we brought it together, it was specifically to ensure that we were bringing consciousness and thinking, biology and well-being, behavior and effectiveness into the work environment, because it's exactly what work environments need to be effective. And so what Superloop is doing is it's helping us understand that by default or design, it's either happening to us or we are taking the lead in making it happen, right? And so what we say is you're either using your super loop or it's using you. And that's true. And so if you're unconscious, these same things are happening. Your beliefs are still going on. They are the you know, underwiring of your brain. They're feeding in to your physical health or not physical health. They're feeding into your neurological system because you have beliefs that you're not even aware of. And so your biology is showing up in ways that are responding to those beliefs. You know, Gabor Maté, who talks so eloquently right now about trauma, you know, talks about the fact that, you know, trauma is actually fatal. It is potentially fatal, and stress is potentially fatal to us because of the fact that if we're not aware of interrupting that self-reinforcing cycle of superloop, that it will create such chronic dis-ease inside of our system that it will make us not be able to function. It will require us to take more days off out of work. It's going to require more medical dollars, all of those things that are not effective for us. So in the super loop, we are getting people very grounded, aware, and connected to the reality that perception is a reality. Your beliefs, they feel like they're on autopilot, but you get to choose what beliefs that you want to align with. I have a very strong belief over periods of time, reciprocity. Reciprocity has always been really important to me. And, you know, when I look at my mom and dad, I know exactly where that came from and our family of origin, right? That is still really important to them. Well, if someone does something nice for you, you should do something nice for them type of mindset. And it's beautiful. But what happens when reciprocity is using me and I'm not using it is that I can use it to manipulate people. I can do something for someone so that they do something back for me. And then it all goes all haywire. And that's what we're trying to prevent. That if I understand that reciprocity is important, I go into something saying, Susan, choose into this. Okay, this is your choice. Decide to do it without attachment to what someone else is going to do or not going to do. And if there is an attachment, be verbally clear about it. Explain to them, so cool, I'm going to do this for you, and this is how it's going to go. I have an expectation that as a result of this, you're going to be able to do this. Is that true? That is all it takes. So that belief informs my biology, which regulates myself. So I'm not now thinking, how do I, you know, make sure that that person does this? My body is now aligned, and I can start sensing in my body. I can start feeling, you know, that, you know, that gut sensation doesn't feel really good. Maybe I should like think about this in a different way. You know, my eye is twitching right now, which tells me that I should pay attention to something in myself. Our biology is a result of thinking that happened in the past, but we chronically think, as we said, and so What we want to make sure is that how are we using our biology for us at, rather than against us? And then the behaviors come out of those beliefs and the biology. The behavior is a response. We think about, you know, the vagus nerve and our nervous system, right? You know, we have fight, flight, or freeze, where that kind of reptilian brain happens. Then there's the amygdala and the middle brain, where emotions and short-term memory. And then there is the prefrontal cortex, which is where critical thinking, executive function happens. And so we can tap into either one of those. They're going to have a very different behavior, right? So if I am not aware that that belief of reciprocity is something that means something to me, and yet I judge through it, right? Because that's what we do when we have beliefs. We judge. Because if you don't share that belief, the brain does that for us. It's not the human, it's the brain does that. It is tracking for certainty. So the beliefs inform the biology, inform the behavior, and then it is a self-reinforcing cycle to the point that if we don't interrupt it, it just keeps going and going and going.
So I'm hearing that there are loops that are unhealthy. And I would imagine the super loop is the loop that you're helping to construct of health. And again, in so much of what you're sharing, there is self-awareness that is super important. There is choice and understanding of the choice that you're making and the why, which then drives the behavior following. And this is a part of perhaps that healthy super loop. You're helping individuals to develop within their self, which then impacts the environment in which they're showing up to every day, whether that be an organization, whether that be a family, whether that be, you know, any other type of communities that we exist in.
Absolutely, 1,000%. And, you know, how we do anything is how we do everything. And so, yes, it, you know, if I gain these skills at work to be able to communicate in a way that meets your needs and my needs, guess what? I can now do that at home too, right? And that's what we're looking for. We're looking at the whole human. Yeah, yes, the practice, we do it in communities at work and organizations, but the reality is this movement of super loop praxis and awareness is about transforming humanity in a way that is going to minimize disease in our bodies, increase performance in all areas of our life, and most importantly, joy and love and all of those good things that feel like they may not be so accessible in some moments.
I'm going to ask to dive just a little bit deeper. And I think we've been in this world. And so I want to ask, how does a healthy super loop, or how does the super loop, improve our happiness, responsibility, productivity, and the ability to utilize our awareness and our executive function?
Great. So we have a phrase that we use all the time. We've trademarked it, actionable awareness, Tammy. And actionable awareness is exactly what you think it is. It is the ability to be aware and then act on that awareness. And what we know is that the gap between awareness and action is where suffering grows. So we are very committed to creating thriving lives and thriving organizations rather than suffering and struggling humans and organizations. And so the ability to be aware, you know, you brought up the term executive function, really important, because what we know about plasticity of the brain, that our brain changes. And, you know, growing up, it was, well, you know, you're like that because you're Italian, you're a woman, you're this, you're that. We had every excuse in the book as to why, you know, Susan's behavior was Susan's behavior. And there was this, you just had to accept it, like, wow, you know, like, yeah, I guess I am. And then we use it as an excuse, right, to kind of perpetuate those behaviors. When in fact, when we think about agency and power, that whole theory totally gives away our power and our agency. Our goal in creating, you know, what we also call as life-affirming workplaces is to help people recognize that your brain is constantly growing and repeating patterns, or you interrupt it with new behaviors and you know, muscle memory, and thank the divine for the design of synapses that they can prune away when you don't use them and regrow. What fires together wires together. And so we can grow new neural patterns in our brain that will help it not be so hard to lean into that tough conversation, to advocate for myself if I'm a people pleaser, to be able to create boundaries out of love rather than boundaries out of manipulation. And so all of those behaviors really integrate so that we're more effective in all areas of our life.
It's beautiful. And just the overall, perhaps mental health that comes from engaging in developing your super loop and being aware that you have a choice to develop your super loop.
It is mental health, Cammy. It is mental well-being, you know, and I laugh because, you know, when I hear that word mental well-being, it is emotional well-being. It's not just the thoughts. It's more about your emotions than it is about your mental well-being. But it's one of those terms that we just use out there, but it's almost an oxymoron, you know, because it really is our emotional health. And yeah, this work creates that type of environment, which allows the best of that human being and that humanity in those teams to show up.
So prior to our listeners going out and purchasing Super Loop and bringing it into their homes and into their lives and into their workplace, what is one small practice that you would like to share that we can all start with to kind of prime the pump in getting ready to embark on this? What is one small practice our listeners can take and start putting into practice to work towards developing a strong, healthy super loop?
Yeah, that's great. And I appreciate your wanting to make sure we have a good takeaway. I would tell you of the 40 or so practices we have in the book, the one that I do on autopilot at this point in my life, but is really connected me to my own emotions, when I am detaching from my own emotions, when I'm disassociating from them. It's a practice called recapitulation. And what that involves is at night, when I'm in bed, just about to go to sleep, I take 5 to 8 minutes and I go through my entire day and I think about, okay, I woke up this morning and how did that feel? Was I anxious when I woke up? And so I'm checking in during that recapitulation about the entire day. So I'm basically cleaning it out of my brain. I'm cleaning it out of my space and saying, yep. And then, you know, I had a conversation with my son and it was a little agitated. And yeah, I think I'm going to follow up with him that. And then I had this call. And so I'm walking through my day to actually process, literally formalize a practice of processing emotions and my day. And at the end of those, if there is something that feels that there's something more there, Susan, because, you know, you're talking about it this way, but there's something more, I prioritize it. You know, I keep a notebook next to my bed. I roll over, I write it down. And, you know, once a week, I sit down for a longer time to journal and I process through that. And I just journal through. So that situation that happened with my son, Anthony, you know, that was challenging. This is not first time it happened. How am I going to show up differently with that? And then I would, in actionable awareness, make a commitment to do something differently. And that might be a clearing conversation with Anthony to just get real with him and say, hey, you know, sometimes when we meet, I just want to let you know, like, I have anxiety about that. I get nervous because I don't want us to do that dance that we do. And I'd like to think about doing this in a different way. Can we have that conversation? So I am empowered to do my own emotional healing. And so to get in that practice every day, you're really just cleansing out your emotional body. And it is one of the simplest and my most favorite. We shower every day. We brush our teeth every day. We eat food every day. But our emotional being is so stuck to the side until it booms out of us in either the crying or agitation. And it's because we're not in relationship with it enough. And so our ability to be in relationship with our emotional being is really important.
Wonderful. So the practice is really taking some time to reflect, get curious, and observe your day and cleanse the emotion or cleanse the day at the end of your day. And anything that may feel sticky or a little bit like a thorn in your side, or just, there's something that may be a little wobbly or a little off, go ahead and place that down in a paper outside of your brain, you know, in a journal or what have you. And then take a moment to process that even deeper. And so it's the practice of being present with your emotions, self-reflection and then overall self-awareness. What is this, you know, moment of resistance or this moment of anxiety or this moment of frustration? What is it telling you about your triggers and how it connects to these emotions so that you can be better aware and process your emotions more fully before they end up just boiling up in you in some sort of way?
Sure. And disease and yep. Perfect capture of that recapitulation, Cammie. And all of that is surrounded with actionable awareness. So mm-hmm. if I sit down and process that there's something going on between me and Anthony, and yet I don't do anything about it. Okay. I promise you it's going to come back again. And so that's where the suffering and the opportunity is, you know, both of those.
Absolutely. I want to end with a question of what are you excited to see or experience if Super Loop was in the hands of everyone in the world? What is your vision and what are you excited to see?
I envision the Super Loop movement being about liberation and empowerment. I have seen it again and again where this practice reminds people, it remembers them to themselves, and it liberates them in a way that they forgot was even possible. And that's what I envision for this work in the world, in the workplace, in universities, and anywhere that there are, you know, more than two of us in community. These types of practices are really healing. We only heal in community. The AA movement, the way the indigenous populations healed that we know of, community matters. And so that's why one-on-one counseling is great. If we do this as communities, this thing will capitulate into the stratosphere, and this won't be the minority that are doing it. It'll be the majority of us that are practicing healthy relationships to ourselves, to each other, and that will change everything.
I mean, it's a beautiful vision to think about self-liberation, returning home to self, authenticity, mm-hmm. and this kind of using love as a pillar and tether and groundedness to the Super Loop. This has been such an expansive conversation. I'm so grateful for you to come on and share about what you have put your life practice into and the development and growth and even the launch of Super Loop and really this high level vision of just health and well-being amongst all throughout the world. It's big work, it's heavy lifting, and you've made it approachable and digestible and accessible to individuals to pick up your book and start that practice and journey on their own and apply it to whatever world that they are existing within. So thank you for your leadership in this space. Thank you for your experience, your knowledge, and your energy. Your energy was wonderful. I cannot believe how quick this conversation went. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. You as well, Cammie. Thank you for the work that you do in bringing this work out into the world. Your kindness and mojo and generosity are just delightful. So thank you for that as well.
Thank you. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take the opportunity to share with a friend, follow Mindful Warrior Radio, and leave a review. To learn more about Mindful Warrior and Mindful Warrior Radio, please follow us on Instagram at The Real Mindful Warrior and check out our website at www.mindfulwarrior.com. I look forward to our next discussion here on Mindful Warrior Radio.